Yati tang chatavi purisa yugani ata purisa pukala esa bhagavato sawaka sango ahuneyo pahuneyo takineyo Anjali karaniyo anutarang punya ketang lokasa tamahang sangang abhipujayami tamahang sangang sirasanamami.
A Metta Sutra. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, not busy with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm, and wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety. May all beings be happy, whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be happy. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths.
this is said to be the sublime abiding. I not holding to false views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being free from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Sadhu, sadhu.
Okay, here's the question box now. Only a few questions in here this evening.
Whoa. That won't last. It never does.
Everything going okay? Good. It's all recorded. One thing about the questions, the Q&A, is that it does give you a chance to focus my attention on parts of meditation which either weren't explained thoroughly enough or you're confused about. And instead of just me deciding what to talk about, you choose the sort of the subjects. And it makes it much more interesting and more productive for everybody. Here on this retreat, I always make sure that the first day or two is relaxation time. Don't do too much. And try and encourage, inspire, but keep it quite simple and easy. I know that sometimes people get afraid of going to retreats. And hopefully you're not afraid of this retreat, which I run. Because you can get up whatever time you like. I just looked at the program today. You're supposed to get up at 4 a.m. in the morning, but it is optional. You can always get up earlier if you want to. Or later, because we trust everybody here. And you should never feel afraid that someone's going to tell you off if you get up late. But if you get up early and then you fall asleep when you're meditating, then that disturbs yourself and other people. So make sure you get enough rest and enough to eat. And after a while, just the program tends to get quite natural. You get up in the morning because you're not doing very much. You don't get so tired as you would do at home when there's so many responsibilities and duties to tire you out. And here you just got your own room, your own program. You know where the food is, where the drinks are. You can shower whenever you want. And you've got nothing to prove on this retreat. Just learn how to relax and be peaceful. And so the first couple of days, don't expect very much. And then after you really get into it, you get settled in, then meditation becomes much easier. It's something which I think I said this morning, but I never said fully, never explored fully. It was some time ago I realized that every part of the meditation practice, which we do, every stage, for want of a better word, of the meditation, there's always these three levels. And just those three levels are recognition, familiarity, and ease. And it's very similar to when you come to the retreat center. It takes a while before you recognize where everything is. You recognize your room, where the electricity switches are, the showers, where to get extra soap if you need soap. You recognize just if you need extra little bits of tea or coffee or juice or something, where you can get them from. You recognize the ways in, the ways out, and there's nice little places you can go to meditate or go for a walk. After a while, you get to know the place, you recognize it. Once you recognize where everything is, the next stage is familiarity. Well, you know the place, it's your room. And with familiarity, you get this wonderful next stage of ease. You feel comfortable there. You'll be surprised after 3 or 4 days that your room is like your home. You get used to it. And it also means that the first night you go into your room, you never get a good night's sleep the first night. You've got to get used to the place. But the second night, tonight, will be a much better sleep for yourself. And the third night will be just like your own bed at home. You said this recognition, familiarity and ease. So you can relax and just enjoy the place. That's exactly the same which happens with meditation. All these different stages of meditation, whether it's the breath, you recognize what the breath is. What do we mean by watching the breath? After a while, you recognize, oh yeah, that's the breath. And then the next level is when you familiarize yourself with it. It's just my breath, that's all. It's nothing strange. It's not scary. And because it's familiar, you can relax in the presence of your breath, and so you're at ease with it. And that's the stage where you can start watching the breath for long periods of time. When you haven't really recognized what you're supposed to watch, first of all, it's impossible. When you're not familiar with it, you know, it's sort of okay, but there's always some tightness and tension there when you're watching the breath. But when you're really at ease with it, having gone through those three stages, recognition, familiarity and ease, it's simple. It's good fun. It's like being with a friend again. And in the what comes next with the meditation, delightful breathing, which is really good fun. But if you find delight in your meditation, first of all, is this what's supposed to happen? You've got to recognize what we're talking about, first of all. Once you recognize it, become familiar, oh, it's just the delight again. And then you can relax with it and be at ease with it, and it lasts a long, long time. And then when you get the really big states like nimittas coming out, incredible sort of lights in the mind, they can be scary for some people. And still many times on the interviews people ask me, was that really a nimitta? It can't be a nimitta. It must be some light. And you may notice in this hall over here, all the lights are high up, so you can't see outside and see what's going on. And on these three sides, they're all closed with shutters. Those are the only sides where the sun can shine through. That direction over there is south. And the sun doesn't go over there in the southern hemisphere. It's always circling around this side of the hall. So if you see a light in this hall, it has to be a nimitta. So there's no other way. No one comes in here with flashlights. You don't see car headlights. If you see a light here in your mind, it is. But it was just, to me as a teacher of this type of meditation, I thought, oh, why is it that people have so much doubt? But after a while, you get so you recognize, oh, that's nimitta. And when it first comes up, yay, nimitta, woohoo, yeah. And of course, it goes away. Once you get recognized, you become familiar. Oh, it's just the old nimitta again. Really amazing state of meditation, but still, it's just nimitta. And you become at ease with it, which means even brilliant states of mind, you're at peace with them. You don't interfere it. Just like your bedroom, after a while, your bed, you can have a really nice night's sleep in it. You can relax in it and have a long time of resting. The same in the deep meditations. When you know those three stages of recognition, familiarity and ease, then you can stay a long time in beautiful meditation. And there's wonderful benefits for you. Anyway, let's do the questions here. Dear Ajahn Brahm, I'm a little confused about this morning's talk where you mentioned it's controlling if we notice our mind drifted and bring it home. I thought that's what we're supposed to do. Stay single-pointed and train our mind to be single-minded. Please kindly clarify. I can appreciate that question because that's what I thought for many years. But it doesn't work. I mentioned if you notice your mind drifted away and bring it home. Where is your home anyway? What is the home? Instead of trying to bring it somewhere, we notice what's happening. So we're aware of it. It's going off. And once you're aware that it's drifting off, that is enough. And you care for it. Okay, mind, if you want to drift off, that's okay with me, but I'm going to drift off with you. The simile, which it's hard to get similes to explain the meaning of these things, but the best simile which I came up with was, you know, about earlier on this year when, you know, I used to go travelling to teach meditation and give retreats and give talks all over the world. Sometimes people ask me, said, you know, how do you feel about travelling? And I said, I don't go anywhere. And I said, what are you talking about? You go to Indonesia, Hong Kong, South Korea, and Thailand, and all over the place, and United States, and US, and I said, it's the same place, isn't it? UK, and Canada, and all these other places. What do you mean, you don't travel? I said, I don't travel. I just get on the aircraft, I sit down, I don't do anything, I just sit there. The aircraft does all the travelling, I just do the sitting. I don't move, the aircraft does the moving. I look out the window, and when it takes off, it's in one place, when it lands, it's another place. It's amazing, but I don't go anywhere. I change my perception of what movement is. Same as a drifting mind. My mind doesn't drift off. If it goes over there, I go with it. If it goes over there, I go with it. If it comes back again, I come with it. So I'm always aware of it. Trouble is that sometimes you drift on places and you think, I shouldn't be there. And so that's when you make a judgment, a value judgment. I shouldn't be there. You want to be somewhere else. That is called wanting and suffering. So instead, where you are, that's where you are. So be there. And the only thing to do is to be kind. This wonderful compassion and kindness, which so often is missed out in the meditation. You know, that's I mentioned this morning, the second factor of the Eightfold Path. You know, it's called Samasankapa. Sometimes the translations would make me tear out my hair if I had any on my head. Sometimes they call it right thought. And I think many of you should appreciate by now that the thinking, it actually disturbs the mind. When you're thinking, you're not seeing reality, you're seeing your description of reality. It's not right on the spot of what's actually happening. You're thinking about it. So, to me, there is no such thing as right thought. And it doesn't even mean that either. The sankhapa, if you look just where it fits in and how that word is used, a much better translation would be right motivation. It's why you are practicing. Not what you're thinking, but what's the energy, the direction of what you're doing. And not in terms like of a goal, an aim, when you don't know exactly where this is going to end up. But how you're practicing. And the three, it makes it very clear when you say what those three right motivations are. The first one is a motivation of renouncing, giving up. To make it nice and clear, I say just the making peace with things. It's renouncing the controlling and the wanting and the not wanting. That's what you're letting go of. And the second one is kindness. It's called avyapada in Pali. It's like non-ill will. And when I saw that, I think, at last, that's where the kindness comes in on the Eightfold Path. Because you knew that compassion, kindness was so important. It was one of the qualities of Buddhism which attracted me as a Westerner when I first came across it. But where was it in the Eightfold Path? And there you saw it, in the middle factor of the second factor of the Eightfold Path, the right kindness. And the other one, which again, very important, was the gentleness, ahimsaka sankappa. And everybody knows that word thanks to Mahatma Gandhi, who his policy of non-violence, ahimsa. That's a Sanskrit word, this is a Pali word, but it means the same. The gentleness in meditation. And that was so important as well, not just going, right, I'm going to get enlightened today. Right, no sleep tonight. Right, let's really do it. That is not Buddhism. It doesn't work. And so many people make that mistake. You know, just really... Okay, I'm going to tell my lovely, stupid personal stories. The first Waisak celebration, which I celebrated, was in the university. I was only 18-year-old. 18-year-old. And I heard the story of Waisak, and where the Buddha sat under the Bodhi tree and he made a resolution. Even though my bones turn to dust and my blood dries up, I will not move from this spot until I get full enlightenment. And I thought, wow, that's so inspiring. So I went back to my room. I sat down, an arrogant young student, and said, well, if he could do it, why not me? And I sat down on my cushion. My maximum meditating at that time was about 25 minutes. But I didn't care. I was going to sit meditating. Oh, somewhere. Oh, yeah, that's very kind. I was going to sit meditating. I wasn't going to get up at all. Even if my blood dried up and my bones turned to dust until I was fully enlightened. I was serious. I had lots to do in my life. I get enlightenment out of the way quickly. Just like, off I was sitting. And I did beat my personal best. 35 minutes, I think, maybe 40. By which time I was in agony. It was really tough. And I opened my eyes and I realised I wasn't enlightened. My blood had not dried up yet. My bones were still solid. Oh, my goodness. But you know that tendency in people? Always to think, well, this is how it should be done. Just using your force of will. And it does not work. And even in the mild sense, okay, I keep bringing my mind back onto my breath. And it goes off, you bring it back again. It goes off, you bring it back again. And you think just by that training, your mind is going to stay on your breath. It does stay on it more often, but it misses the point. Why? Why does your mind keep wandering off? And when I ask the question, why, instead of just keeping thinking training, like a mindless training, keep doing this, that's a bit sort of mindless. Why? Why does the mind not want to stay with the breath? And after a while, it became quite obvious. Because my mind and my breath weren't the best friends. We didn't like each other. One of the reasons we didn't like each other, because every time I was watching the breath, it'd wander off and I'd bring it back again and bring it back again. Oh, crikey, this Brahma Wangso fellow. But then when you were kind to your breath, that kindness. Okay, if you want to wander off, off you go. And then it'll always come back again. Pretty quickly. Because it wanted to be with me. Okay, that's a bit of a, you know, how does the breath have any wants? But that's the best way you can describe it. It felt comfortable with me. And that was why it stayed. So if you really want to be sort of one-pointed, say on the breath, if you like the breath and the breath likes you, of course you stay long. I also remember that time when I was visiting UK, giving a lot of talks as usual, but then there was one old friend of mine from college days. His name was Harold, and during the college days, you know, one party we had over there, he got drunk and he came out of the toilet without his trousers on. You know, we call that, you know, flashing. It was not sort of on purpose, but, you know, I saw it, all the girlfriends saw it as well. So he could not live down the... His nickname became Flash, Flash Harry. It's a student thing. And, you know, we always called him that, Flash. And so when I saw him at Victoria Coach Station, I was coming in from Cambridge, I gave some talks over there, and his job, he was the top actuary in the whole of Europe. Now, actuary, you know what accountants are like? There might be a few accountants here, I'm not sure, I better be careful what I say. But accountants are supposed to be very, very conservative, you know, always wearing suits and ties and being very, very, on the outside, dull. And this was actually more of an accountant than an accountant, an actuary, who does statistics all day. And he was another top one in the whole of Europe. He'd done very well in his life. And I said, oh, how are you doing, Flash? And he looked at me and said, don't say that. It'll spoil my reputation. I'm the head of Europe, so please. But he was such a good friend that, you know, we had a chat together, and then I was going to have my lunch in a Sri Lankan restaurant not far from Victoria Station. And I went in there and said, all right, if he comes in as well, because we hadn't finished talking. And I was talking all the time, and he was talking as well. And I really had to apologise to the host of the Sri Lankan restaurant. I never did any chanting. I gave a quick blessing, because I was talking to my friend all the time. They were very happy that, you know, to feed me and my friend. And then after the, you know, if you ever go to these dhanas, they take a long time. After this restaurant meal was finished, we still hadn't finished chanting, so I was going to the Wimbledon temple, Thai temple, and so he came with me, and we were chatting all the way. And that's not usually my character, to just talk for hours. Not, you know, up here in a microphone, yes, but talking to you and talking to a friend. I just don't do that. Even to the monk friends, I don't talk to you that long. Not hours and hours and hours and hours. And I really wonder why. Why? Because, you know, we had that friendship for such a long time ago. And after so many years, you know, not seeing one another, that friendship was still so strong. And so it was, we hang out together. That is to say, with my breath. My breath is a really good friend. So we hang out together. And so you don't need to pull it back again. Sometimes you need to push it away. I've got to get up now. So that is what I meant. But you don't keep... runs it off, bring it back again. So why does it go away? So... And this is an important part of the Buddhist practice. It's not just through force, not through fear. It's always like through wisdom. Why? Why do people have arguments with people they like and love? Why do people feel they need to prove something in their life? Why? And they ask all these questions. When you ask a question, why, and you find out what's going on, then you don't have to keep bringing the breath back every time. It just stays with you effortlessly, because we're friends. And that makes the meditation so much easier. After a while, you give up, fed up with keep bringing the breath back. When you get to be kind to the breath, and the breath is kind to you, best friends. And then, of course, you stay together for long periods of time. So that's what I really meant this morning. I know this morning I was quite tired because I mentioned that simile of recognition, familiarity and ease. Because even last night, you know, I didn't have a good night's sleep in the room. I've slept there such a long time in the past, but just the first night took a while just to settle in. So I was a bit tired this morning. Thank you, Ajahn. I'm being self-critical because I was harsh in my speech to a work colleague. How can I be accepting myself when I feel that I was unkind? I'd be accepting because you realise in your life you don't have to be perfect. How many people are perfect in this room? And how many people are honest? Keep your head down. We all make mistakes from time to time. And the story, to make it quite clear to you, is hopefully that when you're on this retreat, you don't just sleep in your room and have tea by the dining room and eat and come in here. It's a beautiful forest around here. At least have a little walk around. And if you walk around in the forest here, please see if you can find the perfect tree. Now, what is a perfect tree? I mean, one which is really straight, with all of the branches, you know, where they're supposed to be, with only green leaves on, no yellow leaves or brown leaves, green leaves, and leaves which haven't got bugs on them or haven't been eaten by the cockatoos, and no damage on the bark, no sort of burn marks or things hitting it marks, a perfect tree. Do such trees exist? See if you can find one. You won't be able to find a perfect tree at all, because that's not nature. So why are you trying to be perfect? The skeleton, yeah, it's a skeleton, but it's got no leaves on it. Yeah, but it's, yeah, I know. That's called a beautiful tree.
It reminds me of...
Reminds me of what? Fair enough. But to see a perfect tree don't exist, like human beings who are perfect don't exist. We try to be as perfect as we possibly can. I'm not supposed to scratch my nose. I'm not supposed to touch your face. Oops. But they don't exist. And then instead, you go and look for a beautiful tree. And of course, they're all over the place in the forest. Some people like skeleton trees. I like twisted trees, all bent and crooked, with lots of bumps, knobbles on the bark. There's lots of them around. They're not perfect, but they're beautiful. Nature made them that way. There's storms, there's bushfires, there's heavy wind and heavy rain. And sometimes, you know, one tree falls on another. That's nature. So there's always damage to the trees. And in fact, I often say that every tree in this forest is damaged goods. Have a look at it, you can see the damage. Just like every human being is damaged goods. Some more damaged than others. I'm not going to look at anybody. But number one, if you're a damaged goods, a tree in a forest, you belong. You're supposed to be here. That's what trees are in a forest. That's what human beings are. If you're damaged, you belong. Number two, the most damaged trees are sometimes the most beautiful. The one you like so twisted and bent. You don't have to be perfect to be beautiful. And that just gives you a totally different idea of what beauty, what smartness, what kindness, what wisdom is. You don't need to feel, oh, I just was harsh in my speech. Yeah, sometimes we're harsh in speech. The person probably needed it. But did it work? Anyway, you are doubly harsh. You are harsh in your speech to your colleague, and you're harsh in your thoughts to yourself. That's double suffering. So instead of having double suffering, you feel guilty. Guilt is something, it's weird. But another thing which I really liked about Buddhism is it wasn't guilt. Guilt wasn't part of Buddhist psychology. You're not supposed to feel guilty about things. Which was weird. I mentioned that the other day when a fellow just had to sentence him to 50 strokes of the cat. There was no guilt and punishment. The two of those go together, guilt and punishment. That's what happens in law. The judge confirms you're guilty. Bang, guilty. And the next thing they do is get the punishment. They always come together, guilt and punishment. So no punishment, no guilt. In other words, instead of feeling guilty because you said something wrong, think, what did you do? You're mindful of it. You're kind to it. You forgive. It's beautiful forgiveness. Which means that you don't have guilt and punishment. You forgive. And then you learn from it. You learn. I don't want to listen to someone saying harsh things to me, so I won't give it to other people. I'll be more restrained in the future. So you learn from your mistakes. That's all. You don't punish yourself and feel, I'm a terrible work colleague. I'm a terrible monk. I say bad jokes every day. And a bad joke today. I know, you monks have heard this one. That's the one about the guy who goes to the faith healer. He wants to go to a faith healer. And his friend said, oh, don't go to that faith healer. She's hopeless. Why? Well, I went to see her about a week ago. And she was so boring. She was so boring, even this other lady in the front in a wheelchair. She was bored too. After 5 minutes, she got out of her wheelchair and walked out. Okay, you get that bad joke. Anyway. So anyway, that's what to do. Harsh in your speech, forgive it. But you learn from it, anyway. Acknowledge, forgive and learn. AFL. Is it okay to do stretching exercises outside our rooms? As long as you stretch yourself and don't stretch your work colleague. Or anybody else. And outside your rooms, it should be okay, as long as you don't get into anybody's space and way. And don't make any noise, because sometimes you do stretching exercises at 3 o'clock in the morning. That's not a good idea. So, of course, stretching exercises are fine. Especially just, you know, for those of you who have any back problems or other problems in your body. That was one of the... I was saying this to someone the other day. Just, I don't know if you ever remember... Some of you may remember when I was building the front wall at Bodhinyana Monastery. And I was a builder at that time. And the concrete was delivered. It went off really fast. And I had to level it all, you know, to the step footings. And it was really hard work. And I realized my back was really aching. But, you know, I decided, well, let's finish it. Otherwise, the concrete will be really hard. And that caused a lot of problems. Felt okay at the time, but that night was a bit sore. And of course, then you realise you'd really messed your back up. And so, it's good fun in a sense. For about 6 months, I was half bent over, just like an old man. And people tried all sorts of stuff to get my back straight again. You know, it was just some of the whatever's between those vertebrae had squeezed out. We were just doing some stretching exercises was what cured it. Simple yoga exercises. And after that, my back's been fine ever since. So, really, stretching exercises are great. So, stretch your exercises outside your room. And, of course, the best stretching exercises, I told you that yesterday, is you need to also stretch the muscles around your mouth with the 10 push-ups in the morning in front of the mirror. And please, when you're on a meditation retreat, please you can smile and laugh. Otherwise, people come and visit and they think, wow, who wants to do meditation? It makes people so miserable. Devachan, how do you explain the concept of COVID pandemic in Buddhist perspective? I don't explain it. That's a job for doctors, not for monks. Because we don't know everything. So it's nice to be stupid about some things. In Buddhist perspective, I don't know, it happens. In Australia, we'd say S-H-I-T happens. So does COVID-19. So we accept these things. It's only bodily stuff. Anyway, people are just so concerned with physical stuff. We know with the COVID. But what about the mental reaction to it? That's where the Buddhists are really strong. Well, you know, I try and be careful, be mindful, so you don't sort of do stupid things and infect other people. A lockdown is great in Buddhist perspective. When you have lockdown, you can meditate much more. You don't have to go so far around the world. And what else is there? With COVID-19, okay, what is the virus behind it? It's corona virus, but we pronounce that differently in Buddhism. We call it karuna. That's why we got that book which Ajahn Bamali did about Karuna 19 virus. You got a copy of that book? Yeah, it's 19 stories, which he did for my 69th birthday. So, what Buddhists do, we take any tragedy and we make use of it. Somehow or other, you can always find a positive side to it. Yeah, you know, it makes us reevaluate, you know, our life. We always plan way too far ahead. What are you going to do next year? Where are we going to go? Where are you going to go on holiday? Where were you going to go on holiday if it wasn't COVID? You know, it's so hard, I think you all recognize this, it's so hard to get on one of these retreats. The only way that about half of you got on this retreat is because of all the people who couldn't come on this retreat because of COVID. They can't come from Melbourne, they can't come from Sydney or from Queensland, they can't come from overseas. So hooray for COVID. That's why you're on this retreat. That's being pretty honest. So you can always see something positive in whatever happens. Anyway, Ajahn, I read, that, you know, with reading stuff, first of all, translations. I already mentioned that, the translation of, like, right thought. But it's also the translation of meditation as concentration. Oh, that just really just... It does not mean concentration, it means stillness. It changes a whole lot of how we meditate and why we meditate. Concentration, that's what you learn at school. Come on, concentrate. And okay, this is an old joke, but here we go again. If meditation meant concentration, what would this place be? A concentration camp. And that's how we make you concentrate. We have guards making sure you get up at 4 o'clock in the morning. We have other, we have CCTV cameras. And if any of you talk and disturb other people, that's it. No breakfast and lunch for you today. And it's the whole idea of concentration is never really... It was a great sort of suggestion by Professor Rice Davids, who, you know, he was the first person to translate these Pali words into English. And, you know, just great merits to him. He came up with the word mindfulness. He actually, he coined that term, wonderful term for sati, mindfulness. But concentration, nah. But the problem is, once you have that word, you know, in meditation circles, it's so hard to change it. It does mean stillness. And in the Chinese version of the monks, the Buddhist suttas, it's very clear. These Chinese professors have told me that it means stillness. The Chinese were much smarter than the English. Should I say that? Oh, I've already said it. Because they got it right. Stillness. Now imagine stillness is what we're here to do. That's why I keep it quiet. Shh. Relax. Just take it easy. And you find that you can walk much slower. You can sit down much longer. Your body becomes more still. And your mind becomes more still. When it comes really, really still, it doesn't move at all. Just like I'm in an aircraft. I'm still, it's the aircraft doesn't move. Then you get so peaceful. And energy builds up. You're not moving. And it's natural, it's very easy. It's not forced. And you get these incredible states of meditation. Anyway, Ajahn, I read, that's the first line. The Ajahn Chah suggested meditation is focused on seeing things through impermanence, unsatisfactoriness and emptiness. How do we find emptiness in our thoughts? You've got to empty your thoughts out. So, until all the thoughts come out. So emptiness means empty of what? So this is actually how the Buddha taught in the Sunyata suttas. He said, first of all, you can practice emptiness on this retreat. What is missing on this retreat? Your work, first of all. You don't have to go to work in the mornings. You're free from the responsibilities of your duties. You don't have to clean up your house. You're free of the house. Here, you're free of so much traffic, so much noise in this retreat. You're free of schedules. Yeah, we have evening meetings, but you don't have to come. It's all recorded. So if you have a nice meditation, just stay in your room. You can listen to the talks afterwards. It's a, you're free. And emptiness creates some freedom. And also, you can see in this room over here, how empty is this room? How many people in this room? How much space in this room? Which is the greater? Of course, the emptiness in this room is far greater than the things in this room. But we've got onto this way of perceiving things. You know, girls, boys, old, young, monks, teddy bears. But we've forgot to remember what embraces all of those things, what connects and what's between us all, what connects us. The space. The space is always much more than the things. Even if you do have some thoughts, the space between thoughts is always greater than the thoughts themselves. We don't notice it. Now you noticed it. The space between my words. There it is again. The emptiness. So little by little, you empty your awareness of the thoughts. Empty your awareness of time. And time is just the future and the past. They are just sadistic. You don't have to think of the future. Most of the stuff which I thought about the future never happens. So what you think is going to happen, something really terrible, it doesn't happen. It's usually something much worse. Or usually something much better. And what we think of the past, why are you so burdened for the past? You can't change it. It's gone. Finished. Bye-bye, past. Oh, but we can learn from the past. You don't learn from the past. You learn from the present. So if you change all the concepts, and learn from the present, not the past, and to realize that now is where your future is being made, you have a wonderful sense of freedom from time. What time is it now? I don't know. That's why in that walking meditation room we have the two wonderful clocks which somebody made for me. And you can change the time yourself, you can turn it around, whatever. So if you're feeling very hungry, you can turn it around to sort of, was it 11 o'clock in the morning? But why are we prisoners of time? So imagine being empty of time. That's actually what happens when you get into some nice meditations. You don't know what happens, what the time is. Okay, I'll tell you this lovely story. Hey, that time went really quickly. I'm not going to be able to finish the questions. I apologize. There's only a few questions. But anyway, this is a story. I love telling this story. A Vietnamese monk over in Sydney some years ago. Ajahn Sujata told me this story, but he won't tell me who this monk is. Theravadin, forest monk from Vietnam. And he started, he was teaching a retreat, same format here, 9-day retreat, 7:30, I think, the half an hour meditation, 8 o'clock the talk. The opening day, Friday night. At 8 o'clock, he was still meditating, this monk, sitting up in front. 8:30, still meditating. 9 o'clock, hadn't opened his eyes yet. You know what all the people on the retreat did? They all left and went to bed and left him there, meditating. In the morning, they came up for the morning meditation. He hadn't moved, he was still sitting there. Meditated all night. When it came for the morning chanting, no, he was still meditating. They went to breakfast, he was still meditating. They came out for the morning talk on Saturday morning, he was still meditating. They went for their lunch, he didn't move. He stayed there for 8 days. Didn't move, didn't go to the toilet, didn't take any water, no food. Just sitting there, that's deep meditation. That's what happens. Really inspiring. But he apologized afterwards. And he said, I'm sorry, I was supposed to give the talk, but I just got into a deep meditation. How can you meditate for 8 days? It's not 8 days. The time vanishes. Time has no meaning anymore. So you're not a prisoner of time, you're free of time. It's wonderful when those things happen. You're sitting here and just, your whole concept, perception of time is gone. You're sitting here just so peaceful in this moment, enjoying it so incredibly much. And you open your eyes. 8 days? Oh, sorry. That happens. So you're empty of time. And then you go even deeper. You're empty of this body. Body's vanished. It's gone. And you're inside your mind. And then things really start to vanish. Okay, let's say things. The thought vanishes. So quiet. Not a thought in the mind. Your will vanishes. Really aware, but you can't do anything. All the will is gone. That's so cool. That's an explanation, description of second jhana. And then other things vanish as you go deeper and deeper into the beautiful jhana states. That's emptiness. Came out afterwards, wow, lots of things were missing. And the more that are missing, the more joy and bliss you have. Anyway, I better do the next question, otherwise I'm in trouble. Hi, Ajahn. Work into my kind of saw. Oh, something into my mind. I saw flashes like a speeding train come across an image of the Buddha meditating facing a brick wall. Emotions came with tears. I let go because I could not understand. Okay, that's nice. Not that you let go because you couldn't understand or you came afraid. They came with tears. Great. This is like nimittas. Nimittas, lights which appear in the mind. This would probably happen. You probably recognize, maybe after I describe, that your body had mostly vanished. You couldn't feel your body sitting. You wouldn't be able to hear sounds. Having a wonderful time. Saw flashes of light. Those are just in the start of nimittas. Image of the Buddha meditating facing a brick wall. I don't know what the brick wall was about, but seeing a Buddha meditating. Emotions came with tears. Great. This is a beautiful pity sukha. But you still had enough of your body awareness that tears came out. So you didn't actually go inside. It just remained on the outside. I let go because I could not understand. All that's happening over here is your first experience, maybe, of these lovely nimitta experiences. Very powerful, very beautiful. If there were flashes of light, one of the common signs that it's a nimitta is that the colours are more intense than you can see with your eyes. If there are yellows or reds or blues or greens, they're more green than any green you can see in the world. It's like you take a green colour, I'm just looking at the tape in front of me, and that colour, more green than that, intensify the greenness, and it becomes like otherworldly green. That's typical of nimittas. And of course, once you recognise these things, they're not dangerous, they're great. They're wonderful. Just let them come. Don't try and control them. Recognise them, be familiar with them, and at ease with them, and they stay a long time, you have a really great time blissing out together. And they're great for your bodily well-being as well. It's amazing just how many... The thing is that diseases, illnesses and stuff tend to vanish when you get into these sorts of states. Wow. I asked a question which has stumped me. I don't think I can answer this one. Can you see if you can answer it for me? Wow. The best question. It's blank. Okay. Sorry. Oh, dear Ajahn Brahm, Buddha says that the root of all suffering is desire. He never said that. He doesn't speak English. That's not being silly. There's an important point there, that sometimes we quote Ajahn Chah said this or the Buddha said that, but he said something in Pali. Do we get the translation right? Is that the real meaning? The root of all suffering is wanting. Desire is a little bit too intense. Even small amounts of wanting causes suffering. Can you stop wanting? Can you stop? If you stop, you vanish. You disappear. Yourself vanishes. So the real root of suffering is not desire or wanting. It's where desire and wanting comes from. Your identity, your sense of self. It's what a self does. It does things, it wants things. So when wanting starts to disappear, so do you. You're gone, baby, you're gone. Sorry. That's why when you do get peaceful, it's scary. Because you're vanishing. And that's the scariest thing. When I was a kid, the scariest thing was some demon would come and said, I've come to take over your soul. Nowadays, so you're welcome. Nothing there. Take whatever you want. But is desire is a very form of suffering, yeah. But the root cause is a sense of self where desire comes from. Can we live in this world as a household and understand the nature of desire? Do we have to become a monk or a nun? Thanks, Ajahn, hoping you're always being well. If you're a householder, you can understand these things. First of all, what is desire? I was saying today, sometimes we think we can understand what letting go is. Know the word, but have you really done letting go? Really done it and just things vanish. It's scary when you let go. And who was it some time ago, this meditator had a dream on this retreat. And her dream was, she was driving in the car, she was the driver, and I was in the passenger seat. And she lost control of the car, it was going really fast. And I was saying, just relax, let go. But she was grabbing the wheel and trying to put the brakes on, and she saw that we were going to go over a cliff, a really big cliff, to certain death. Ah! And I said, take your hands off the steering wheel. Take your feet off the pedals. And because it was a dream, she actually did that. She took her hands off the steering wheel and feet off the pedals. So what happened? The car went straight over the cliff. But then, hadn't hit the bottom yet. So she saw at the bottom of the cliff, there was a road. And, you know, like cliffs, it's not like sort of a right angle. It's, you know, it just bends. And so there's a good chance we would take the bend and the car would level out, which it did. But there was a really hairpin right-hand turn. And she went to grab the steering wheel again and said, hands off steering wheel, feet off pedals. She did that. And so we went down, hit the bottom, and the car leveled, and it turned a perfect right turn and went off nice and peaceful, safe, with no injuries at all. She was so proud of that. She said, now, okay, very good. Now, please, you're not allowed to drive me home after this. Don't trust you. But do that in your meditation, because that's what works. To be able to let go. So she was learning what letting go is. The same way you're learning what desire is, what wanting is. What is it? And the only real way to know what wanting is to experience when wanting is gone. There's no wanting. How can a fish know what water is when it's always there? I won't do the tadpole simile yet. I'll leave that for another day. But a fish can't understand the nature of water. Only when desire is totally gone from you, then you understand what desire is. Till that time, it's going to play around with you. It's not your desire. Nothing to do with you. Just conditioning. Anyway, Venerable Sir, did Lungpo Cha ever explain his experiences in the Dhamma and what enlightenment is? Okay. Yes. And the monks have heard this one before, but it was one of the great stories. Personal, because it has to be personal, simply because other monks talk. Sometimes you don't have the full story. And sometimes you don't know whether what they said was true. This is a personal story with Ajahn Chah, which is one of the most wonderful ones. So I was six or seven, 8 years as a monk at the time. So by this time, my Thai and Lao were almost perfect. I would give talks for hours to lay people in Thai or Lao. And the Lao was the local dialect which Ajahn Chah spoke. But anyway, when Ajahn Chah started to get sick, we built a sauna for him. And the sauna was allowed in Buddhist monasticism. It wasn't, the saunas weren't invented by the Swedes. They were Indian. And saunas were quite common in the time of the Buddha. So we knew it was possible, so we built a sauna for Ajahn Chah. And he would come to our monastery every week to take a sauna. But we got the payoff because he'd always give a talk before taking a sauna. And this time, I should mention to you that sometimes what Ajahn Chah said was just really boring. But every now and again, he just really hit the spot and it would just be so amazing. It's worth 10 boring talks for the one good one. And this was the day he gave a really amazing talk. I forget exactly what it was, but it just, he was so inspired afterwards. And there's many other monks looking after him, doing the duties for him. So I just went round the back of the hall, you know, found a nice quiet spot and just meditated for 2 hours. So simple, so easy. You just sit there and just, you're blissing out. And almost from the very beginning, because you're inspired. It's something I haven't said yet. One of the great causes for deep meditation is the joy you have beforehand. Something has really moved you, inspired you. Oh, this is brilliant, this is wonderful. And you sit down there and just, you go deep so quickly. Why? Because you're happy to be here. You don't need anything else. You don't want anything. So there's a big boost of Dhamma. Wow. So it's one of those really great sermons which he gave, and I just was blissed out afterwards. And when I came out of meditation, didn't know what the time was. But the first thought was, maybe if I'm lucky, I can still do some service for the great teacher. So I got up and started walking by myself. And I saw Ajahn Chah coming the opposite direction with his driver. I think it was another Thai man there. It could have been just him and one driver, or just him and two Thai men, going back to his monastery, Wat Bopong. This was in Wat Nanachat. So anyway, we were going to cross. And at that point, when we were about to cross, you know, Ajahn Chah stopped. He looked at me. Ajahn Chah knew what he was doing. He looked at me. I'd just come out of a really deep meditation. And he looked at me. And the first thing which I noticed was him, I can say this because he's passed away, now just reading my mind. I don't know if you can imagine, you're standing there, looking at your teacher, and the teacher, you feel like he's actually going inside of you, and you can almost like feel him inside your brain, or inside your mind. And it was literally reading my mind. And for once, I didn't mind. It was nice and clean and inspired and joyful and free of all these hindrances and stuff. Take a look. You know what it's like? That sometimes you've just got a new house and it's all clean and you're proud of it. And you say, hey, come in, have a look. Amazing, that's what I thought. And then when he sort of went out, it's amazing the feeling at the time. It's like someone was walking inside your mind. That's how I perceived it. Anyway, he came out afterwards. And then he looked at me really fiercely, just grabbing my attention. And that's when he said, Brahma Wangso, why? He asked me, why? Fiercely, but no, with not any malice at all. Why? And then I answered. I gave him the answer. I don't know. I could meditate, but my wisdom wasn't that hot. So I don't know, I said. And the wonderful thing with a great teacher, he just laughed his head off. He never criticized you or hit you or say, you stupid monk, why do I have to teach people like you? He just thought it was so funny. And he laughed and laughed and laughed. And then he stopped laughing, looked at me again. And he said, Brahma Wangsa, I'll tell you the answer. And I was just so interested in this. The answer to the question, why? One of the great monks who just read your mind. So, you know, he had the goods. So, why? I said, yeah. And he said, the answer is, there's nothing. And he did it with such respect. There's nothing. And then he looked at me and said, Brahma Wangsa, do you understand? I said, yes. You've heard it before so many times. He said, no, you don't. And he walked away. And
And I felt just so low afterwards. But that's what enlightenment is. It's nothing. Do you understand? No, you don't. Oh, that's good old Ajahn. Oh, the last one. How do you describe a serene mind? You don't describe it. You cannot photograph it. You can't capture it. That's one of the difficult things when Ajahn Chah says there's nothing. Now, what does he really mean? These are incredible states of mind. How do you explain nimittas and jhanas and serenity? Oh. Sometimes great poets have the abilities to take a powerful emotion and put it into words so people can sort of recognize it. But they can never actually explain it fully. Even the great poets can't do that. So, a serene mind, don't try and describe it. Enjoy it. Experience it. Don't ever think it can be captured. The idea of how do we describe like the summit of the Mount Everest? You put a flag on top or something, and you destroy it. Or you put a restaurant on top. That's what they used to do. First of all, flags, then restaurants, and now they put communication Telstra towers on the top of it. So can't you leave it alone? But how you can get close to understanding it, again, like peace. So, here's a nice way of describing it. Is in your life, I'm going to break a little rule here, remembering your past. In your past life, your past of this life, sorry. So far, what's been your happiest ever moment in this life? I don't mean happiness of like, you know, you passed your exams or you've fallen in love or you've had a baby or something. There's something which is much deeper. The most deepest happiness, joy, contentment you've ever had. Where in that particular time and place, you didn't want anyone else than was already there to be with you. That nothing was missing. You couldn't improve it at all. If you had a magic wand, you couldn't make it better. It's wonderful moments of deep, profound joy. Well, I recall some of those moments. It's amazing. I was so happy there. Why? It wasn't nice weather. I still had lots to do in my life. There are moments where you pause and you're totally happy. You didn't want anything to change in those few moments. You could just enjoy the time. And I realized that why they were happy, content, joyful, because I didn't want anything. There was no desire in those few moments. It all stopped. I was just enjoying this moment. I didn't want anything else in the whole world. That was why it was very deep peace, serenity. Wasn't disturbed by trying to improve it or trying to get rid of something which was disturbing it. Nothing I needed to do. It was serene. So the serenity was the absence of all these desires and ill wills. I could just enjoy the moment. And they weren't the best places in the world to be. But it's a place where I could just go and just be and didn't need anything or want anything in the whole world. So you could stop thinking. You could stop wanting. Future vanished. Because the future is created by wanting. The two of them go together. Imagine you didn't have any future. Then wanting would be like a missile with no place to land. You need to have a future, a destination for your wants. And the same if your past disappears. then all the ill will and anger, and so the guilt and the other stuff which comes from thinking too much about the past, that too will vanish. Yay! No past, no future, nothing to worry about. Imagine how free that will be. That's a little bit, a tiny bit of what serenity is. Where you don't want anything at all. That makes sense? Hopefully it does, because that's all you're getting. So, thank you for listening tonight. I'm sure that tomorrow there'll be many more questions tomorrow evening. But it's nice to have just not too many. So thank you again. Sadhu. Sadhu. Big one. Sadhu. Very good. And don't ever think that I invented all these, you know, sadhus and stuff. This was a Thai forest monk called Ajahn Singtong. And that's what he used to do. I couldn't believe it at first when I went to his monastery. I went to his monastery, a famous Thai monk. Unfortunately, he got killed in an aircraft crash. But when he gave the blessing, first day I was there, he started giving the blessing. And this is how it went. I'll do it very quickly. Yata wari waha pura pari parenti sagarang ewa mewa ito dinang peta nagu pakapa iji dang pati dang. And that is a pretty accurate of how he did this. And I thought the monk was crazy. But, you know, he just was so wise in many things he did. And all the villagers would come every day. All of them would. I never saw that even with Ajahn Chah. And they loved him because, you know, he was connecting with people, a bit of fun and joy in the Dhamma. Wonderful monk. So anyway, that's from him. Okay, so have a wonderful night's sleep. And hopefully you're familiar now with your room and at ease, and have a great night. See you in the morning, whenever.